Welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we talk about the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Central Catskill region. Health Cetera in the Catskills is broadcast from the WIOX radio station in Roxbury, New York, which is the ancient and unceded territory of the Esopus clan of the Lenape people, also known as the Munsee, who were the first caretakers living with this land. Today, we live in the influence of what is now called, what is now called the Lenape Nation of the Northeastern Woodlands in the United States and Canada. Their territory includes present-day northeastern Delaware, New Jersey, and eastern Pennsylvania along the Delaware River watershed, New York City, western Long Island, and the lower Hudson Valley. Well, the nursing shortage is a concern for most countries, including the United States, and it's really of concern even more so now because of the shortage, because workforce shortage that we have because of COVID. The United Kingdom is a country that has long had a policy of filling gaps in the nursing workforce with nurses from other countries, as has the United States. And both countries have a track record of not always treating migrating nurses well. In fact, one case in the United States about now, I want to say 8 to 10 years ago, found that the Sentosa nursing home chain on Long Island had engaged in what was the Justice Department called human trafficking of nurses, recruiting them to work in their facilities at wages lower than the prevailing ones. So bringing them over to this country with promises of great jobs, great wages, etc., great life. And once they got here, taking away their passports and their visas and threatening to report them with criminal prosecution if they didn't go along with unsafe staffing patterns and other egregious practices. Well, Dr. Calvin Morley is a nurse and midwife from Trinidad and Tobago who migrated to the United Kingdom some years ago and is now living in the United Kingdom and chair of the Diversity and Social Justice Institute of Health and Social Care at London's South Bank University. He's many other things as well, including the recipient of a Churchill Fellowship, which is quite prestigious in the United Kingdom. And he's come to the United States actually to look at what we're doing around nurse migration and issues around structural racism and equity. And I'm really pleased to welcome Calvin Morley to Health Cetera in the Catskills.
And thank you for that warm welcome and introduction.
Pleased to have you on today. And I want to start with you just quickly sharing your own story of migration.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, my migration story is that I qualified as a nurse in the UK. So my story started where my trajectory and journey is that I left the Caribbean, Trinidad and Tobago, where we were a British colony, so we were entitled as such. We were able to go to England, United Kingdom even, and we could train as nurses. So that's where I took up my nurse education. But now there are much more hostile rules, which doesn't allow that to happen anymore. And I say hostile rules, I mean immigration rulings. So now that sort of scheme that I went under is no longer available to people.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that. But the UK is very much importing nurses from other countries, right?
Yes, they are. So, the UK at the moment, you know, as of July 2024, we had 46,800 plus nursing vacancies in our National Health Service, which is just over 10% of the total nursing workforce that we have in the UK.
Mm. And how is that felt? Describe to listeners what difference that makes.
So what that does is it creates longer waiting lists. So, you know, our National Health Service is free at point of entry. So it's a free service. It's based on, you know, government funding. and therefore we don't pay for health care as such, although private health care is available. But what this means for us is that we have longer waiting lists because there aren't nurses to see patients, to triage them, to look at them in outpatients. We have longer working hours because, you know, there aren't enough nurses to stretch to that. And it's really and truly, at the end of the day, it impacts on patient safety. Because if we don't have the right number of nurses to look after patients, then the patient's safety in hospital becomes an issue. And that's one of the things.
That's absolutely right. And so you've become very concerned about the treatment of migrating nurses because of this global shortage since COVID. Wealthier countries are really going after nurses, particularly in poorer countries. And in some countries where actually the preparation of nurses for export to other countries is actually an industry because the nurses send back money to the home country, support their families that way, et cetera. So what are your, so this is a practice that's been going on. It's rearing its head again in terms of ramping up and more recruitment efforts. What are your concerns about this?
So, okay, here in the UK, our biggest countries we recruit from are India, the Philippines, and Nigeria. So, for example, with India and the Philippines, in 2022-23, we recruited almost 7,000 nurses from those countries that came and joined our register. So this, what this does then do is two things. There are some countries, like the Philippines, who train their nurses an export commodity, as you highlighted. So then they, you know, they go and they send an income back home, and that helps. But on the other hand, we're also doing a brain drain. And there are some areas or rules in the UK around ethical recruiting, but people always find ways around the ethical recruitment, and they still become unethical in their recruitment.
Say a little bit about more about that, the unethical recruitment.
So we have what we've zoned countries, such as they're a red list country. So if those countries themselves have a nursing shortage, we should not be recruiting from them. But in effect, what we do is we find little clauses that we can go around and recruit people into nursing. Or sometimes we end up, I say we, the hospital that's recruiting will end up paying a penalty fare for just recruiting from a red zone country.
And then there's also the issue of how nurses are treated once they're in country. And you shared with me the other day, and I was quite stunned by this, that there are nurses who have migrated to the UK who have committed suicide for reasons having to do with them not being enculturated into the, brought into the culture of the country, to them not being treated fairly. Tell us a little bit more about that piece of the ethics of this migration, recruitment of nurses from other countries.
So this was documented, the treatment, the poor treatment of internationally recruited nurses into the UK around 2012 and 2008. So it's not a new issue, but what it has now grown because the population of those nurses have also grown. So the discrimination they were facing has just been magnified, or it's you know, in factor with the numbers we see at the moment. One of the things is that, and we say this, and it's not for sensationalizing, but we have found that black nurses are more likely to face disciplinary actions, which we call fitness to practice here, through our Nursing and Midwifery Council, who is our regulator. It's worth to note that in the UK we have one regulator for the whole all four nations. What we have found is those people, those black nurses, when they go to disciplinary, compared to their white counterparts, they receive harsher penalties. And that then becomes we begin to see part of the discrimination picture forming.
Yes.
We also have in the UK, before I tell you about, you know, what individual nurses and the suicides, for example, we have what we call the Workforce Race Equality Strategy. So it's almost like a yearly census where we look at what hospitals are doing and then we report to them based on race. So, for example, we have gradings and we call them very senior managers. So black staff, nursing staff, very senior management level has increased from 201 to 325. That was in 2018. It hasn't moved much since then. We know that 76% of NHS hospital trusts, white applicants were more likely than black applicants to be appointed from shortlisting. So now this, although you recruit someone into, this is where the discrimination begins to lay. You can be the most experienced nurse in Africa. You can be the matron or the chief nurse of a hospital. If we recruit you to come and work here in England under any of the other United Kingdom nations, we will start you off at the lowest possible band, which is called a band 5 nurse. We ignore your experience and your skills and your knowledge. So that's why when this data, I tell you about this data, that 76% of white applicants are more likely to be appointed over BME. That's because when people now come and they try to apply for promotions, they don't get it. And
go ahead.
Sorry, were you?
No, go ahead.
You know, just to say some more, a little bit more in figures, you know, almost 40% of black staff believe that their hospitals don't provide them with equal opportunities for career progression. And in 2022, we had up to 28% of staff saying they experienced harassment and bullying or abuse from other colleagues in their where they work. And the same also about 18% said they receive abuse from patients. So we also have, just to answer your question around the suicide, when our nurses come, they have their, like we all do, we carry our cultures with us. And looking at the countries I told you our nurses come from, India, the Philippines, Nigeria, honor to family and communities is very important. So when a nurse is, you know, put up for disciplinary and ends up in the Nursing and Midwifery Council investigation, they find it very difficult to deal with, and they see it as breaking honor to their communities. And so, therefore, in 2023 alone, we had 6 nurses who were referred to the Nursing and Midwifery Council committed suicide. One nurse actually lit himself alight in front of the hospital where he was working. So this is the level of how migrant nurses are treated.
It's stunning. It's really stunning and very sad. I want to note for our listeners that these conditions that Dr. Calvin Morley is describing are issues in this country. I have to say, Calvin, that since the murder of George Floyd and raising the awareness of inequities in our society, and including in healthcare, there has been a real commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion, and creating a sense of belonging within the nursing profession. And so we are seeing many more promotions of nurses of color or highly qualified who before in the past may not have gotten the promotion because of structural racism, of intentional or unintentional bias. And we are making some progress. There's more that needs to be done. We still, the profession still doesn't look like the people we take care of, and we have to diversify even more. But I have to say that I feel like some progress has been made. Now, there is this backlash here, as I'm sure you know, with saw the new administration wanting to get rid of all DEI initiatives that they can control. But the profession has made a commitment. I don't think there's any going back on that. Well, I wanted to just talk for a minute about some what's called bilateral agreements between nations and why these are important. What are these bilateral agreements around migration?
So I think bilateral agreements have been around for quite a while. But again, because we have the nursing shortages, it becomes even more prominent for us now. And I think at the very basic level, the starting level, bilateral agreements help us to improve healthcare quality. So, you know, it helps us to ensure that people who are in the system, they maintain, our international nurses who come in, they help us to maintain good access and care standards. But just going back one step further, when I say bilateral agreements, I am talking about having agreements between the host country and the other country you're recruiting from. So rather than calling it recruiting, like we go to India, the Philippines, etc., we can have agreements where nurses can move for economic or philanthropic reasons. They can move. So, for example, one scheme that I know of is that the Minister of Health in Jamaica has signed agreements where he will ask nurses to come and work for 2 weeks for him. So, for example, let's say they have a backlog of doing kidney surgery or any sort of renal surgery on patients in Jamaica, and their list is so now backlogged, they will say, if you're a theater nurse or a recovery nurse, please come and work for us for 2 weeks while we approach this list. And then the agreement is, you can come into the country, you can do that for them as philanthropic reasons, for example. And then they say, we know what, we'll give you a 2 weeks all expense paid holiday after you work for 2 weeks for us. That's a very simple agreement. There are other agreements where I'm thinking of where we should be able to move from one country to the other freely. So there's this economic migration that happens. There's this social mobility of nurses where I can say, from England, I can go to the Caribbean and work. I can work there for 18 months. And then from there, I can move to Canada and work because there's an agreement. And we know a lot of nurses like using their profession and their professional registration to explore other countries and cultures as a tourist as such while working and living there. So I'm looking at how, when I talk of bilateral agreements, I think we need to look at how we can do those. And the WHO has really started this by setting out a really good blueprint policy for us on how we can start, you know, looking at bilateral agreements. So, they've endorsed that, which is good. So it means that we're not really taking advantage of other countries. If there's some soundness to it. So I think bilateral agreements can help us with, you know, addressing the shortages we have, improving the healthcare quality. It can help us with ethical recruitment, so it stops the exploitation. Mm-hmm. You know, earlier on you were talking about a nursing home that were bringing people in Long Island, I think, yes. And how they were treating them. Bilateral agreements can stop those exploitations.
Yes.
It can ensure nurses receive proper compensation and working conditions. They can help to improve skill development and exchange. So I can be a nurse and go to a less developed country and share my skills and my expertise. You know, look at how we could expose people to technologies and techniques that they can use. So, and you know, there is obviously, as I said, the economic benefits. So I think there is lots of work, and WHO has set out that blueprint that we can all use as a guide for setting up bilateral agreements, particularly around nursing and health workforce. So I think we have a really good starter.
Yes, and I might say another aspect of this is some of the wealthier countries, high-income countries, recruiting from low-income countries, the low-income countries paying for the education of these nurses, and then the nurses get lured away. And these low-income countries can't afford to pay the same wages, can't afford to keep producing more and more nurses. So there also is a window for bilateral agreements to say that high-income country must pay the low-income country for the education that nurse received so that they can prepare another nurse. You ask some countries, why don't you just prepare more nurses? Well, they don't have the capacity to do that. So you want to help build capacity in low-income countries. So we only have about a minute or so left, but you are here on this Churchill Fellowship. And what are you going to do when you go back home?
So the whole basis of my Churchill Fellowship, as you said, was to look at the discrimination and racism that nurses face, and to see how I could learn from American colleagues and implement something. So my whole aim is to set up a center for African nursing and midwifery in England. There's never been a center for African nursing and midwifery. And I see that center from being here so far as having an arm for professional development, a pipeline into research and doing research, and becoming a policy think tank. Something you had put in my head, Diana, that I needed to look at. And I've really started looking around that. I mean, the Churchill Fellowship is about learning from the world, inspire, and how we can inspire change in the UK from learning from the world. It's a charity, and I'm really and truly looking forward to how I can inspire change in the UK from learning in this part of the world.
Well, Dr. Calvin Morley, Chair of the Diversity and Social Justice Institute of Health and Social Care at the London South Bank University. It's a pleasure to have you in the United States, and to have you, it's a delight to have you here on Health Center in the Catskills. And I hope that the rest of your travels are very warm and a lot of opportunity for learning and for sharing, as I've certainly learned from you in our discussions while you've been here. So I wish you a very safe and rich journey.
Thank you very much for having me. And thanks to everyone who's hosted me so far. It's been a wonderful trip.
Good. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, he's doing really good work, and I had the opportunity this past weekend to show him, to take him to Russ and Daughters in New York City and have him have a proper Jewish, New York Jewish breakfast. So, that's our program today. I'm Diana Mason. You've been listening to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains.